So, Urchatz is, I forgot where I saw this. I saw this idea, and I really liked it, and I tried to find where I found it, and I couldn't find it, but I like this idea a lot. You know, I'll talk about this a few different times, but there's a concept of matchilin beginus and mesayim b'shevach, that there is a flow to the Haggadah. You start off talking about the bad and end up talking about the good. You start off lamenting the past and the slavery and the suffering, and you end up celebrating the freedom, okay? The Haggadah is supposed to be a process of transitioning from slavery to freedom. So in the beginning, the focus is more about slavery, and at the end, it's more about freedom. So how does Urchatz... So we have two hand washings. We have the hand washing in the beginning, without a bracha, during kind of the slavery component of the Seder, and then we wash our hands before eating matzah, and that's when we say a bracha, and that's the full regular hand washing. So now it's more symbolized the freedom. That's already happening. You finish the Haggadah, now you're eating the meal, you're eating your matzah. That's already more freedom. So how does the first Netilas Yadayim of Urchatz represent slavery? So I saw this nice idea that, you know, when someone is a slave, but not just a slave, if someone is challenged in some way, and they need to make big changes, they have a big transition happening, so the feeling often is, do it 100% or don't do it at all, right? Or someone feels that, if I can't do it right, I won't do it at all. What Urchatz represents is, it's a partial Netilas Yadayim. You're doing the hand washing, but you're not saying a bracha, you're not eating, you know, matzah afterwards. It's like, you're just washing your hands. It doesn't seem like it's anything, right? Without a bracha, wash your hands doesn't seem like anything. There's nothing substantive, there's nothing significant, there's nothing holy about it. You're just washing your hands. Without a bracha, it's just nothing. The message here is, sometimes the steps you take in the beginning are small and seem insignificant or incomplete, but they're an important part of the process of growth and of improving yourself. And so just as the Jews, as they were leaving slavery and they were idol worshippers and they were not ready for this and they were not at a level that they deserved this, they had to go through a series of little steps of progression. And those first steps often are incomplete and often don't really, you know, aren't really the ultimate goal. But those steps are important too, and those steps are significant. So we have the Urchatz, the hand washing in the beginning representing slavery, to show the steps that they took and the steps that sometimes we have to take to remind us that those steps are important too. Just as, and at the end of the Seder, you know, more towards the middle, when they wash their hands already with a bracha, that's signifying the growth that they made and the growth that we can make. That by that time already, look, but if you start doing the Urchatz, you know, the incomplete mitzvah in a sense, you will end up doing the full mitzvah in the end. That's kind of a lesson of the Urchatz. I like that a lot. It's not my idea. I saw it somewhere, but I don't know where, so I apologize for that. Okay. Number two, a second idea. The Belzer Rebbe, number two, the Belzer Rebbe felt that Urchatz was not only about washing before karpas, is because the Haggadah is a form of tefillah. That we wash our hands before we daven. And the Rambam paskens this, that you're supposed to wash your hands before you daven. That's why most shuls have an Netilas Yadayim station before you, you know, before you walk in and you daven. So the Haggadah is not just reading from a book, and it's not just learning. There's an aspect of tefillah to it. We say halal, we say parts of davening in it, besides the fact that we're benching. So it's supposed to be, in the fact that we even say halal at night. We never say halal at night. The only time we say halal at night is the first night of Pesach. Part of which says it's a night of tefillah. This is a tefillah of sorts. So he says that we don't just wash our hands because we're about to have a wet vegetable. We also wash our hands because we're preparing for the tefillah that is the Haggadah. So just as you wash your hands before tefillah, you have to wash your hands before the Haggadah. Thomas show that it's a holy spiritual night. It's not just reading something. It's more sanctified. It's something deeper. It's as if we're davening to Hashem. That is a nice idea. Okay, now karpas, everyone's favorite part of the Seder. Karpas. So how does karpas relate to Yetzias Mitzrayim? So, you know, typically we look at karpas as being connected to Chag HaAviv, that this is the spring holiday, which hopefully in New York it will feel like spring by Pesach. That's usually how it's described, and that's definitely a part of it as well. But again, if it's in the beginning of the Seder, that means we have to tend towards looking at it as being more connected to slavery than freedom. So how is this connected to slavery? So Rav Moshe Yaakov Alevi Kanner in Kol HaTorah says that in Bamidbar 11.5, Perek Yud Aleph Pasuk Hey, it says that the Jews complained about the man, longing for the fish and vegetables they ate in Egypt. So the question, of course, is, well, where did they get fish and vegetables? I mean, they make it sound like they were eating at the Prime Grill every night when they were slaves. I mean, they were slaves. They were getting garbage. What are they talking about? Where are they getting all these amazing foods? The Rabban explains that in Egypt, when they worked the fields, they were allowed to eat some of the produce, meaning part of what they did, they built pyramids, but they also were picking vegetables. I mean, whatever was needed. They were doing all sorts of things. So if you're out in the fields, they allowed them to eat. So it's not that they were shopping in the markets and coming back with, you know, a bevy of amazing produce. But when they're out in the field, they would eat some. Which for them was a treat, because otherwise they were eating, we say they ate matzah when they were slaves. That's what's called lechem oni. They weren't eating something that's so good. So karpas represents those vegetables, right? I mean, the karpas representing vegetables showing it represents the vegetables they ate in Egypt as slaves, because they were allowed to eat it from time to time. So why is that so important? So I think this is an important lesson here. Because what did the Jews do? The Jews looked back at their time in Egypt and they complained, right? They didn't like the man, because the man, for many people, tasted the same or very similar every day. You know, you don't have that sensation of something, you know, something chewy, something crispy. It's just the same texture every day. So they fantasized about life in Egypt. And what did they come up with? They came up with this food. Remember when we got to pick the fields and eat some watermelon or eat some of this or some of that. Now, in the grand scheme of things, it's an absurd thing to be longing for, right? It was in the context of their slavery, right? You're working the fields, and that's why you can have some of this. And it shows that, you know, the human capacity to remember the good and block out the bad is a very, very strong and in many ways very positive thing that we have. We like to look longingly and positively about our past. And we do a very good job of either forgetting or blocking out the parts that we'd rather not remember, because frankly it's hard to live that way. So the ability to forget is a very important ability. However, there is some downside to it, because if we fantasize the past, it can make us long for something that never really was. And the message here of the Karpas also is, even these Jews, within a few years of leaving Egypt, but now they're free, when they were slaves, all they can dream about is being free. And now that they're free, what are they dreaming about? Oh, I remember remember the vegetables we had in Egypt, which we don't have now because all we have is the man. And it's a little bit of a lesson to us, not that we have to be realistic. We have to be honest about what was in our past and what we've given up and what we've left. Because it's very easy to fantasize about things and not really remember them in the full context of the reality of the situation. And the Karpas represents the slavery, but also our tendency to do that. So I think that's an interesting lesson from the Karpas.
What is I know we use potato and parsley, but...
Yeah, and vegetables.
Why is it so... Any vegetables fine?
For the most part. I mean, people use celery. I mean, there's something to being green. I know people use potato too, and it's fine just potato. There's something to being green. It's got more of a spring feel to it, more of a vegetable feel to it. Some people have potatoes. I think potatoes and celery. You don't usually use lettuce, because we use lettuce for maro or other things.
Right. Well, maro is another one that is very inconsistent. People use all kinds of
different,
you know, combinations of things.
Yeah, but karpas is, I think.
Most people use potato, right?
Potato and celery. I've seen the most. I've seen the most frequently. I've seen those two the most. Potato and celery.
I've never seen celery.
Really? It's time to
expand.
Open your eyes. Expand your horizons. There's the whole world out there.
Yeah. Well, I hate celery anyway.
Okay, fine. So, doesn't bother you.
And the green thing, the leaf.
The parsley or something?
Parsley, yeah.
Do people really eat that? Like,
Yeah.
Like, yeah? Like, you have enough for carpus? Yeah. I always like potatoes because it's like a little filling, and you know I can eat for a long time, so. Right. Yeah, I can't eat a whole celery either. I have a bite, and I don't like it. Celery? That's okay.
You know you can eat a
whole Yeah, I know, right? I really don't like celery that much.
We need to rethink the whole thing. The chicken wings, pigs in a blanket, whole different five little.
We'll work on it. The chicken wing section of the Seder.
Maybe we should move from slavery.
This is the wing of affliction. This is the wing of
affliction. What do you use for Mara?
We use romaine lettuce, but I always add like real Mara to it. I eat it together. Absolutely. I can't just eat lettuce.
Right.
So I need to have enough to have a kazayas, so I'm not going to eat kazayas.
You put the shredded mara inside the lettuce.
And only the white. Don't come to my Seder and ask for red. Don't even.
Who does red?
Not just white.
I'm not going to name names. There are people out there. What?
Dry white.
The drier, the better. Right. Yes. Let's do this
right. It has to be just shredded.
If you can get
it.
Yeah.
Does it?
It's the best, you know.
I've never seen.
Do it right. If you're doing it, do it right.
Liquid. So.
This is liquid too.
And do you put charosis in there?
No.
Only for the the times you do.
You dip it in charosis, right?
Yeah. Well, we'll go through that. We can go the details. We can go through. Okay, halach manya. So we welcome everyone to our Seder. Conveniently, after Seder has begun. And nobody can hear us because we close the door. So we say, "Halach ma'in dechal avatana ba'aradi Mitzrayim kol dechvin yisei v'chol kol dezrichi tevusach hash da'achal shana ba'aradi Yisrael hash da'avda shana ba'bnei chorim." This is the bread of affliction which our ancestors ate in the land of Egypt. Whoever is hungry, let him come and eat. Whoever is needed, let him come and join in Pesach's observance. This year we are here. Next year may we be in Israel. This year we are free. This year we are slaves. Next year may we be free men. So the Torah says in Or Chaim 4:17, Tav Yud Zayin, that the three Mo'adim, the Shalosh Regalim, are connected to the three Avos. Avram represents Pesach. Yitzchak represents Shavuos, and Yaakov represents Sukkos. So how do we see that, and why does that matter? So we see that with Avram, because the pasuk says, Bereishis 18:6, Vayomer Avram Ohala El Sar, Vayomer Mari Shlosh Im Kemach Solas Lushi Veasi Ugot. So he tells, when the three angels come to visit them, Avram tells Sarah to make cakes. And the Medrash says those cakes were matzahs, and that was Pesach. So that's a connection. We see that Avram and Pesach. Yitzchak is Shavuos, because the shofar that was blown at Har Sinai came from the ram that was sacrificed at the Akedah. So that's the connection to Shavuos and Yitzchak. And Sukkos is from this pasuk in Bereishis Lamed Gimel 33:17. Vayakov nasa sukosa, vayiven lo bayis ulug migneo asa sukot, akein krash emakom sukot. So we have a pasuk that after Yaakov and Esav have their encounter, so Yaakov leaves and he goes to Sukkot. And he builds Sukkot for his animals. And he names the place Sukkot. So we have one pasuk that says Sukkot three times in it. That's already a pretty strong connection. So why does that matter? So Moshe Yaakov Kanner of Toronto says, that's why we specifically on Pesach invite people. Mihaka, we don't have a minhag to invite people to our sukkah. Right? It'd be much easier. We're outside already. Just scream out to the street, hey, anyone need a meal, right? It would be easier. How come there's no element of that in Sukkos or in Shavuos? Only in Pesach do we have this idea of inviting people. So it says, because since Pesach is connected to Avraham, and Avraham's main midah was chesed in hospitality, we need to include an element of hospitality in the merit of Avraham. That's what he says. So nice idea. So that's why we specifically invite people on Pesach. Number five. I like this idea. This is interesting. I'd never seen this before, but I really liked it. So, you know, we have a mitzvah of Higadol Levincha. The modern-day Seder looks very different than the Seders of yore. Right? Why? Because our kids are in school. And our kids are in school. What do? They're spending a month learning about the Seder. They make their own Haggadahs. They have 25,000 Divrei Torah to say, right? They're like super prepared, right? Sometimes they're more prepared than the parents. They've been learning this for a month nonstop. So who's the one who speaks at the Seder nowadays, right? It's the kids more than the parents, right? Every kid wants to say the Divrei Torah, wants to show off their Haggadah, wants to sing all the songs. Now, technically speaking, it seems that this was supposed to be a night where the parents are teaching the children, right? And yet, it doesn't seem to work out that way anymore. So should we embrace that, or should we try to make it a night where the parents are teaching? The problem is, it's hard for parents to teach the kids, because whatever would be at their level to learn, they've already learned. Right? If you tell your six-year-old even, Avadimayinu Leparu Mitzrayim, like, thanks, Dad, I know that already. You're not teaching me anything. So someone asked that question to Yaakov Kamenetsky. So what do we do? Like, should we embrace the fact that children basically have taken over the Seder? Or should we try to, like, you know, keep the way it was and have the parents talk? So he says as follows. He says, look, the point of Yetzias Mitzrayim, and the point of the Seder, is to give your children a sense of emunah and confidence about Yetzias Mitzrayim. So if the children are primarily speaking, and their pride and confidence they get from giving Divrei Torah help strengthen their emunah, then fulfill it that way, so embrace it. Meaning, if that's what's going to help, then do that. Whatever's going to make your children feel more connected to the night, feel that they've learned, feel that they've got confidence, feel like they're part of something, then do that. If nowadays that's the way it is, because the kids are so prepared, then embrace it. So it's a little different than they used to be. So it's a little different, but it's wonderful too. So Yaakov said, don't think that we have to do it the way it was. We should embrace kind of the new reality of the situation. I like that a lot. I thought that was very nice.
Rabbi, do most of your children want to show their expertise and they learn from school?
For the most part. It depends on the personality. Some are more, you know, yeah, or just more comfortable speaking in large groups than others. Certain kids, if I let them, they would just speak for 2 hours straight.
They would.
Some would give one or two little Dvar Torahs and that was it, you know? So yeah, they're all different. Personality-wise, yeah. But I struggle with this. You know, I struggle with this myself because I always feel like I should be teaching them and you spend the whole time listening to the Dvar Torahs and maybe ask a question, a follow-up question. So, you know, if you look at the way it's written and the way historically it's been done, right, that's not the style. But, you know, we should embrace it as opposed to kind of try to push back against something, which ultimately is a beautiful thing, so why are we fighting it? So I like the idea. Okay, Avadimayinu. So we say mitzvah aleinu saper b'yetzias Mitzrayim. There's a mitzvah. So at the end of Avodah Mayinu, we say there's a mitzvah on us to mitzvah aleinu saper b'yetzias Mitzrayim. So the question is, of course, the mitzvah is on us. Mitzvah aleinu. Who else would it be on? You know, let's just say mitzvah saper b'yetzias Mitzrayim. What's the aleinu? Why on us? So Kedusha Salevi in Parshas Bo explains that Pesach is called both Chag HaMatzos and Chag HaPesach. That's the two main ways we refer to the holiday, Chag HaMatzos and Chag HaPesach. So they don't represent the same exact thing. Matzah represents our actions, right? We left in a hurry, showing our emunah, showing we're ready to leave Egypt. So the matzah represents the Jewish people's actions and the credit we should get for how we rushed out of Egypt. Pesach represents Hashem's action. We didn't do anything. Hashem passed over the houses. We were passive. And we thank Hashem for protecting us and saving us. So each of these names represent a different part of the Chag. Chag HaMatzos represents what we did, and Chag HaPesach represents what Hashem did. So it's a bit of a quid pro quo, that if we do our part, Hashem will do His part. We show Hashem commitment, Hashem shows us commitment. We go the extra mile, Hashem goes the extra mile for us. So by saying mitzvah aleinu lesaper, it's saying it's our job to do this, and the implicit message is, and then Hashem will respond in kind. That's how the Kedushas Levi understands it. So I thought that was a nice idea. Okay, then we say, "V'kolam arba l'saper b'tzias Mitzrayim harizim mishubach." Anyone who, you know, the more you tell about the b'tzias Mitzrayim, the more you shall be praised. So, what is the nature of that mitzvah, the "kolam arba l'saper" that can go on forever? The Rebbe from San says that while in Egypt, we don't see the Jews daven, they only cry. They don't really daven. When do they really daven? They daven after they leave Egypt. When the Az Yashir is the first time you really see them daven to Hashem. So, if you mix the letters of Paro, right, you get Pera. Okay, if you just take some letters out and flip them around, para, meaning an inability to speak. After they leave Egypt, they praise Hashem, and that's Azashir. They get a Pesach. So Pesach means a mouth that talks, a mouth that is open, that doesn't stop praising Hashem. So paro is a mouth that doesn't speak, and Pesach is a mouth, like pe, as in Pesach, like a mouth, is a mouth that speaks. So, on top of this is the difference between, so chametz and matzah have two of the three letters are the same, right? The sadi is the same and the mem is the same. So what difference, what letters are different? So chametz has a chet, and matzah has a hey, right? So the chet and the hey, can I borrow your pen for a second? So the chet and the hey are pretty much the same letter, right? What's the difference? So if you have a, yeah, I mean, there's your hey, and the chet, you just add, you just close off the opening, close off the window. So hey is open, and chet is closed. So chametz represents our time in Mitzrayim when we weren't talking, we weren't davening. It was closed, it was per-sah, I mean, it was per-ra. Matzah represents openness, because the hey is open. When we left Mitzrayim, that's when we really started to open up to Hashem. That when we were in that tough situation, we had a hard time really davening. We had a hard time really reaching out to Hashem. When we left, that's when we really opened up. So he says that's the kolam marba l'saper, is saying that once we become free, we should be praising Hashem left and right. That's part of celebrating the good. Part of being free is constantly praising Hashem. So that's how he understands this idea of kolam marba l'saper. It's not just about the Seder. It's a general statement that the more, you know, we should constantly be thinking in those terms. The rabbis of Bnei Brak. I found this interesting. The Tzvas Emes is an interesting point. So the five rabbis of Bnei Brak. So let's see if you can, don't read ahead. Let's see if you can pick up what's missing here from this story. So the Maaseh of Rabbi Eliezer. So once Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Yeshua, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, Rabbi Kiva, Rabbi Tarfon were dining together in Bnei Brak. They discussed the exodus from Egypt throughout the entire night until their students came and told them, teachers, it is time to recite the morning Shema. What is missing here? What?
Rum?
It never says this happened on Pesach. When did this happen? Somebody's assuming it happened on Pesach. It's in the Haggadah. But it never says at the Seder. So it says, Shayu Misubin.
I'm sitting around talking about
Yitzias Mitzrayim.
Yeah.
Okay. So you, if you, the circumstantial evidence would say this is Pesach. They're talking about Pesach, the Yitzias Mitzrayim all night. They're misubin. They're you know, the reclining, which is a part of the Seder. So we assume that, but it never actually says on Pesach at the Seder. It never actually says that. So the Svas Emes says this didn't happen on Pesach. That's his chiddush. Didn't happen on Pesach. He says, and what's his proof? So it says Rabbi Eliezer was from Lod, and we see elsewhere that Rabbi Eliezer praises people who stayed home for Yantif. He didn't think you should leave for Yantif. All these guys left their families, and were their families there? Were they not there? How come that on the story? So he says, he couldn't have been in Yantif because he would never have left his family. He would never have been with them in Bnei Brak. So Sfas Emes says that we see it's even a stronger point if it's not Pesach. Meaning, if someone stays up all night talking about Yitzias Mitzrayim on Pesach at the Seder, that's a great Seder, but you're already doing that at the Seder, you're just going a little longer, right? As opposed to if you're doing it on a regular Tuesday night in the middle of, Tishrei or something. That's it. That shows the commitment, that shows that they took this mitzvah seriously of remembering Yitzias Mitzrayim. So he says it's even stronger lesson because he thinks it didn't even happen on Pesach. That's interesting. Okay. Then we say as follows. Number 9. So, the four sons. So this is the introduction to the four sons. Keneged arba banim dibrei Torah. The Torah speaks keneged, against, or it's a hard translation, in relation to four sons. Echad chacham, echad rasha, echad tam, echad shein de'elisho. Okay. And then we said before that, Baruch HaMakom Baruch Hu, Baruch Shem Tentorah Mo Yisrael Baruch Hu. So blessed is Hashem that gave the Torah to Jewish people. So Hashem's blessed because, you know, we thank you, Hashem, for giving us the Torah. The Torah speaks to four sons. These are the four sons. So why start off by saying, blessed is Hashem for giving us the Torah, and then the four sons? Just start with the four sons. What's the point of, what's the connection to the greatness of the Torah and the four sons? So, Rav Aaron Saratsky asks, so why are these two linked? So he explains as follows. Gemara in Shabbos 89a describes the angels' fear in Hashem giving the Torah to the Jewish people. The angels, the Gemara says, didn't want Hashem to give the Torah is so pure and so perfect. Why give it to these imperfect human beings? Hashem, look what they do. Look at these people. You can give them the Torah. They're going to mess this up. They're going to mess that up. They're going to worship idols and they're going to commit adultery and they're going to steal and they're going to murder. Why give this perfect book to them? So Hashem throws it back at them and says, well, what do you expect, you know? And really, this Moshe is involved here as well. So, well, can you murder? And then you say, no, we can't murder. Well, the Torah says, don't murder. You know, can you be jealous? And can you have, can you covet something another angel has? No, we can't. They don't have a Yitzhahara. So Hashem says, look, that's what the Torah is. The Torah is not just something perfect and pure that's supposed to remain locked in a case somewhere. It's supposed to bring perfection to an imperfect world. That's the purpose of the Torah. So yes, it's going to get dinged up, and yes, it's going to be trampled on, and yes, it's going to be ignored at times. All that's going to happen. But that's the purpose that the Torah is there to try to combat all of the nature of humanity that needs to be changed. So what's, okay, therefore what? So he says, we see that the case for the Torah, the existence of the Torah is what? The whole purpose of us getting the Torah, the existence of the Torah, is to help perfect the imperfect. That's why we bring up the four sons. Not just the Chacham. So yes, the Torah is there for the Chacham. But the Torah is there for the Rasha. And the Torah is there for the Tam. And the Torah is there for Shidin Deilu Shol. The Torah is not just there for the Chacham. Right? Meaning, the greatness of the Torah is that it can impact all four sons. There's a lesson there for all four sons. That's the point of the Torah. The point of the Torah is to speak to all four sons. Especially the Rasha and the Tam and Indei Lishol, right? So that's why it starts off saying how great the Torah is, and then the four sons, because these four sons show us exactly what the purpose of the Torah is all about. I love that. I think that was great. Okay, the Rasha. This one's a little out there, but I'm not sure if Joe's going to like this one, but we'll see. Number 10, the Rasha. Rasha Mahu Omer, so the Rasha says, what is this service to you and not to himself? Since he separates himself from the klal, he is a kufar baker. So you blunt his teeth. And you tell him, because of this, Hashem took me out of Mitzrayim, me and not you. If you were there, you would not have been saved. So what does it mean to blunt his teeth? Why are we blunting his teeth? You know, it seems you hit his teeth. You don't knock him out necessarily. You like hit him in the teeth. Okay. So what's the point of that? Why is that necessary? What's the message? So Svas Emma says as follows. He looks at the four sons and the four questions, the four kushyas, as my, you know, my Zay used to say, the Arba kushyas, as connected. Meaning the first question and the first son are linked. The second son and the second question are linked. Okay. So the second son is the Rasha. So what's the second question? The second question is, why do we eat Maror? Second question is about Maror. So this says the connection between Maror and the Rasha. What's the connection? So that's very creative. So the Gemara in Psachim 115b says that what if you swallow the Maror? If you swallow the Maror but don't chew it, and therefore don't taste it, you're not Yotze. You didn't fulfill the mitzvah. You have to taste the Maror. You can swallow matzah, you don't have to chew it. You can just swallow it and that's you fulfill the mitzvah. But if you swallow Maror, you didn't fulfill the mitzvah, because the point is to taste it. Okay. So I mean you have to chew the Maror to fulfill the mitzvah. In other words, you need teeth to fulfill the mitzvah of Maror. So what's the connection? So he says, what's the Rasha afraid of here? He's avoiding something, he's scared of something here. Right? He's very defensive. And he's very evasive. So the Sfas Emes thinks that what the Rosh, he's trying to avoid tough questions, right? He doesn't want to talk about God. He doesn't want to talk about evil. He doesn't want to talk about Mitzrayim. He doesn't want to talk about his past, his heritage. You know, there's some people like that. He doesn't want to get into it. He'd rather just like, this is your thing and I don't care and do whatever you want. He doesn't want to talk about things that are uncomfortable for him. Meaning he wants to just kind of swallow it down without tasting it, right? He just wants to like, okay, I'll sit here in the Seder and we'll just get through it, right? And the message to the Russia is what? No. You have to taste it. I mean, you have to engage in it. You have to address the tough questions. You believe in God? Let's talk about it. You don't believe in God? Let's talk about it. You think this is a good story? Talk about it. You think this story is ridiculous? Let's talk about it. Let's talk about the uncomfortable conversation. Meaning, you hit him in the teeth as if to say, you have to chew on it. You have to listen. You have to engage with it. You have to chew on the maror. The maror is bitter and it's difficult and it's uncomfortable and who wants it? No, you have to chew on it. Don't just swallow it down. You have to chew on it. That's the connection between the Russia and maror. Is that clear? Interesting, right? Did you like that one or no?
Yeah.
It's all right.
I never understood, you know, the Arba Banim altogether. Like, what's their place in the Haggadah? But I've heard a lot of different reasons and explanations, but it seems, you know, like everything is a little disjointed in the Haggadah. This one seems like it's really out there.
Well, I think in the beginning, when you're about to discuss the story, you kind of talk about the different approaches needed to talk to different people at your Seder. You know, that you've got different, not just personalities, but people coming from very different perspectives. And
yeah, but very few of these are very flattering. I mean, the one is.
That's fine. I mean, they're not negative. I mean, the Tom isn't negative. The end of the Lishol, I wouldn't say is.
I wouldn't say negative, it's just not flattering.
Okay. How many people your Seder are.
Yeah, but I don't tell them.
Okay. So, you know how it goes. Everyone looks around the table and says, "Eh, that guy over there, that's the Tom, that's right?" So, if everyone looks at everybody else as needing to be engaged, then we'll have a very engaging, you know, Seder.
Right.
Alright. Tom. So I gave the whole shiur about Tom last year. I'm just a little bit of it, but that was interesting. The essence of Tom is truth, okay? In Gematria, you're allowed to be one number off, meaning if something is, you know, 612 and 613, in Gematria they're still linked, right? So it's, you know, 514, 513. You're allowed plus minus one in Gematria, okay? Yeah, it's a little bigger room.
That and no vowels.
What?
That and no vowels makes it a lot easier to come up with stuff.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. So when they say horseshoes and hand grenades, it's horseshoes, gematria, and hand grenades, right? Okay, why do I bring that up? Because Tom, the difference between Tom and MS is only one. It's an aleph. All you do is add an aleph to get from Tom to MS to truth. So in that sense, they're linked gematria-wise because they're only one off, one numerical value, off, one aleph. So the essence of Tam is Emes. I mean, you know, I talked about in the shir last year.
Sorry, what is Tam?
The simple son. The simple son.
So the word Tam and Tam, like Tam Tov, the restaurant?
Two different things.
So,
yeah.
Oh.
That's with a tet.
That means taste.
Taste is with a tet. Tam is a tough man.
That means again?
So it's hard to define. Simple or naive or innocent or pure, some sort of combination of that.
But is it a pejorative? Is it a negative? Or
no?
It's not really. I mean, there are people in Tanakh called Tam. Yaakov is called the Tam. Noach is called Tam. It seems to be, the way I understand it, is someone who is very committed to truth, sees the world in a true or false kind of way, struggles with ambiguity, struggles with some of the complexities of life, especially with people. Like Yaakov.
So Yitzhak would be considered more of a complex figure who's contemplating a philosophical one.
Yeah, it's not a philosophical. I mean, like someone like Yaakov struggles with evil, right? He struggles with Esav. He struggles with Lavan. He doesn't know how to deal with them. He doesn't know how to handle them. he's not naive. He's, I mean, he's a little naive, but more of a sense of he doesn't understand why anyone would act that way. He doesn't understand why one would see the world that way. You know, Noach as well. Noach struggles to connect to this evil world he's in. He sees, looks around him, and says, "I don't get it. Why would you do this? Why is the world like?" He can't, and he struggles to impact the world because he can't relate to that, basically to all of it. So a tam, the deficiency of the tam, is their inability to know how to address evil, complexity, things like that. That's how I understand it. But that's, you know, so that's why the tam is emes, because they're very truth oriented, right? They're very truth oriented. They see the world in a much more black and white kind of way. If you reverse the word tam, it spells out mates, death, because that's the ultimate truth, is life and death. That's the ultimate reality. So they live in a very keen sense of reality, almost like seeing everything as life and death. The struggle for the tam is to be optimistic in the world when they see evil. They struggle with that. So we need to remind them that just as Hashem saved the Jews from slavery, Hashem can help those who are suffering as well. I mean, the message to the tam is that Hashem took the Jews out of Egypt. That's not a one-time event. Yes, there's evil in the world, but it's not necessarily a permanent condition. Things can change. Things can get better. We can make it better, and Hashem can make it better. So that's kind of the lesson, part of the message we have to tell the tam.
Isn't that a pretty good lesson for anybody,
sure,
not just the tam?
For sure, but some people don't struggle with that nearly as much. Meaning some people see evil in the world and say, people are evil. Right, I mean, certain people assume the worst of people and are surprised when there's good, and others expect the best in people and are surprised when they're evil. The tam is the latter, to the extreme. I guess maybe that's the way of looking at it. And so that's a great, no, don't go into politics if that's who you are, right? But that
you definitely relate to that.
Yeah, so some people can, but that child needs to be addressed a certain way. That's their concern, and that's what we have to. It's part of the message of the Seder for the Tom. He's not simple as in he's stupid. He's simple as in he struggles with the complexity, and the nuances and the ambiguity. All right, let's the fourth son, the Eino Deli Shol, the son who can't ask. So who is the son who can't ask? So two ideas here. The Belzer Rebbe saw this son as the highest level of the four. Now, typically we look at it as kind of, it's not really descending because it seems a bit random. You have the Chacham, then the Rasha, then the Tam, then the Lishol. It's hard to know how to categorize them. You normally would say the best is the Chacham, the second best is the Tam, the third best is the Lishol, the fourth best is the Rasha. But it's not in any sort of sequential order that you could categorize them that way. The Belzer Rebbe saw the highest level of the four is the Eino Deli Shol. Why? So he says that when it comes to tefillah, so how do we typically daven for things? So we have like a list of things that we want, and we know what we want, and so we say, Hashem, please help me with this. You know, if you're looking for a spouse, Hashem, please help me find a spouse. If you want a deal to go through, Hashem, please help this deal work. Whatever it is. You know what you want, you ask Hashem for it. However, the higher level of davening is you just say to Hashem, provide me with what I need. I know I don't necessarily know what I need. And I know I might be davening for things that aren't really in my best interest. Hashem, simply provide for me what's best for me. And there's a humility to that because you're not presumptuous to say, I know what I need. The highest level is someone who's an Eino Deli Shol. They don't know what to ask Hashem for because they don't assume they know what they need. So in essence, the highest level of someone davening is the person who doesn't know how to ask. Because they know they don't know how to ask. That's not just out of ignorance. It's a very conscious decision, conscious approach. So what do we do? The response to the Eino Deli Shol is, At patach lo. You open the mouth for him. And that, he says, that's Hashem. Hashem opens the mouth of the person who doesn't know what to ask for. And Hashem lets him see what he really needs. That's, I mean, the apatachlo is Hashem responding to the tefillah. So that's he took that as a wider perspective. So he saw them as the highest level of the four, because that's the highest level of tefillah, to say to Hashem, provide me with what I need. I don't assume that I even know what that is. And for example, like the Gemara Moed Katan says, you shouldn't daven to marry a certain person, right? Because that assumes that you know for sure that you should marry that person. Well, maybe that's the worst person for you to marry, right? So you should say, Hashem, help me find the person I'm supposed to marry. So if Hashem, help me marry that person, right? It's a nuance, but it's important.
Is that just apply to marriage or just
for anything? Yeah, just anything, right? For anything, we always, you know, we should not be as presumptuous to think we know certain things. Maybe you can say, Hashem, help my children be healthy. Yes, we assume that's, you know, that's objectively, you know, a good thing. But anything that has any sort of ambiguity to it, we should have the humility to say we don't always know exactly what would be best for us. Now, one unique part about this is the Enon de Elishol. So it says at petachlo. So you open his mouth, but it's in the feminine, at instead of ata. It should say ata petachlo, but it's feminine. It's feminine, but then masculine, at petachlo. So why is it feminine? So I just thought maybe part of the message here is that when someone doesn't know what to ask, or doesn't know what to ask, you have to take a softer approach. You have to almost take a more feminine approach. You have to be, you know, be open-minded and softer with your approach to them. So maybe that's why it says at in the feminine, as if to say you need to embrace them and let them feel comfortable so that they can open up more. I don't know, that was something I thought of. Okay. Let's go to the 10 plagues. Favorite plague, Makas Bechoros, the 10th plague. So, of all the plagues, the only one that's called Makat something, right? The one, only one that has the word plague in it is the last plague. It should be Makas Dam, Makas Fardeh. Why don't they all have plague in the name? So the Sanz Rebbe explains as follows. He says that the Medrash says that Hashem warned Paro that every firstborn would be killed, right? If you look in the Torah, Moshe warns Paro it's about to happen, right? It's no surprise. Moshe says, you know, Achatzos, I'm going to come back and every firstborn is going to be dead. So the assumption is people knew. People knew it was coming, right? So let me ask you this.
By the way, that was regardless of gender?
It's really the sons. Yeah, the oldest sons.
So if the oldest was
If there's no sons, it could be a daughter, right?
But if the eldest was the daughter and the second was the son, then it would be the son.
I believe so, yeah. So let's say you're a Bechor, right? And you hear that what the next plague is going to be, okay? So what's your feeling? What do you want to do here, right? Let him go, right? Like, okay, it's been fun and games. We've enjoyed our slaves. We've survived the first 9 plagues. Yeah, we've been told that we're going to die. I'm not going along with this. Like,
did they get a warning?
Yes, Moshe warns Paro and says... Now, the assumption is, the Medrash assumes that everyone knew, that the firstborn knew about this. And what did they do? They started fighting. They demanded.
But in the Torah, it's specific?
Yeah, the Torah specifically says that Moshe told Paro what was about to happen. Yeah.
Why would it matter who was young and who was old? I mean, whether you're younger or older, you're still firstborn.
Yeah, that's true. I guess the way they put it is like sons fighting their fathers. You know, if you're the firstborn, your father wouldn't necessarily be there. So the generation, all the firstborns were basically creating a civil war against the non-firstborn, saying, you know, okay, it's time to let them go. We can't, I'm not dying over this. Like, you know, it's...
It's funny, there would already be a rivalry between firstborn, in a sense, the, you know, the secondborn is, firstborn's gone.
So they want... Yeah, it depends how much they like them. So a civil war broke out as a precursor to the actual plague. So in that sense, there were 2 plagues. They killed each other over the civil war, and then the firstborns all died as well. So it's Makah Bechoro in the sense that there are two plagues, meaning the plague of the civil war and then the plague itself. That's how he understands why it's called Makah Bechoro, to show that it's really double plague.
So this is the first I've heard of a civil war among the Egyptians. Is that a common
Not so common, no. No, I mean, the measure that says this, yeah. So, that makes sense. I mean, it would make sense. I mean, there's definitely times when you see there is...
Happened last year.
Frustration. Yeah. There's been a few civil wars in Egypt recently, right? Okay, Dayenu. So, one of the most difficult lines in Dayenu to understand is the following. Ilu kirvanu fnei Har Sinai v'lo natan lanu et haTorah Dayenu. If Hashem brought us to our Sinai, but didn't give us a Torah, Dayenu, that would have been enough. It's a
weird one,
right? Because, like, you know, you leave us at the altar, like, well, what's so great about that? Now we got to see Har Sinai, I mean, what's the point of that?
Or just even saying that we never got the Torah would be Dayenu is pretty weird.
Right, right.
So, since that's the whole...
the whole purpose. Deal. Right, but I mean, we said Dayenu in earlier stages already, but it seems like there's some value to going to Har Sinai separate from getting the Torah. What was that value? Like, what did we gain by that? So, in the Sefer Siftei Tzadik, this is number 15, it quotes the Gemara Nedarim, Chaf Amud Aleph 20a, which says, if someone does not have a sense of shame, then we know their ancestors were not at Har Sinai. That a uniquely Jewish trait, a sense of shame is seen as a Jewish trait. Someone doesn't have a sense of shame, we're supposed to doubt their lineage. You know, they couldn't really be Jewish. So the Rush and the Ron both explain that Midah was basically given to the Jewish people at Har Sinai before they received the Torah. That part of our unique Jewish character of feeling, having a sense of shame, was before they even got the Torah. So he thinks that's what this is referring to. If we'd gone to the Har Sinai and received this Midah of having a sense of shame, that was already valuable. Even if we never received the Torah. That's what we gained by being there. That's how we understand it. That's an interesting answer. Number 16, Pesach Matzah Maror. So we have to mention these three things, right? We have to mention Pesach Matzah Maror. So for Aryeh Tzvi Fromer, who was a Polish posek who was murdered in Majdanek, explained that on Sukkot, the Torah clearly tells us the intent of the Sukkot. We say, L'man yedu d'orsechem ki b'sukkot d'oshavte b'nei Yisrael v'yohut si otam e'eretz Mitzrayim ani Hashem Elokeichem. So we're told, why do we have Sukkot? So that we know, L'man yedu d'orsechem, so future generations should know that you sat in Sukkot when they were in the desert. So, we have an explicit reason given for sitting in the Sukkot. So the Bach, Paskins, and Or Chaim, and Simon 635, that to fulfill the mitzvah midiraisa according to the Torah, you need to have this intention when doing the mitzvah of Sukkah. So Sukkah and Pesach are interconnected. There's a lot of things we learn one chag from the other. And in the Gemara, it's called Tesvav Tesvav. The fact that they're both on the 15th day of a holiday, they're literally half a year apart, Pesach and Sukkot. So they're seen as being very interconnected. So if in Sukkot we have a mitzvah, you need to have intention to fulfill the mitzvah of singing a sukkah, it would be reasonable to say you need to have intention when doing the mitzvahs with Pesach as well. So we specifically point out Pesach Matzah Maror, why we do it, we have to mention it to say it's not enough to just eat the Pesach Matzah Maror, we have to have intention, we have to have kavana for this as well. All right, Pesach 17. We say that Hashem passed over the Jews' houses and saved their homes. If he passed over them, then didn't he by definition save them? Well, I get the exact language here. So in Pesach Matzah Maror, we say, "Shenamar v'amartem zevach Pesachu l'Hashem, asher Pesach abatei b'nei Yisrael Mitzrayim." So Hashem passed over the house of the Jewish people, Benag Poet Mitzrayim, when he was striking the Egyptians. Vet Batenu Hitzil, and he saved our homes. Vayikod Am Veishtachavu. So it says that Hashem passed over our homes and saved our homes, but that's the same thing. So why is the Torah repeated saying Hashem passed over homes and saved our homes? So he thinks that there's two separate things that happened. First, Hashem passed over our homes, meaning we were not subject to the 10th plague, Makas Bechorus. Our Bechorus didn't die. But on top of that, he says that no one died during this plague. Even someone who would have died naturally, Hashem would not allow anyone to die during this time. So meaning, Hashem wants to make it 100% clear, the Egyptians are dying of a plague, Jews are not dying at all. If a few Jews had died from a heart attack or died from old age, they'd say, well, a few Jews died too. So, okay, more Egyptians died, but they also died. So Hashem would not allow any Jew to die in any circumstances. It's like Groundhog Day or something. Yeah? So that's the second part. The first part is Hashem passed over our houses and therefore Jews didn't die from the plague. Ubatenu Hitzil, Hashem also didn't allow anyone in the houses to die as well. Two separate kind of miracles that happened, two different ways that we are protected. Okay, number 18, Bechol Dor V'Dor. So we say, Bechol Dor V'Dor, Chayiv Adam Nir D'Atzmo Ki Ilu Hu Yatzim Mitzrayim. In every generation, a person is obligated to regard himself as if he had gone out of Egypt, as if you yourself left Egypt. So the Erugas Habosem, Moshe Greenwald, who died in 1910, he was a Rebbe of Chust and a few other places. So he asks, why is this necessary? In the beginning of the Seder, we say, Navadim Hayinu, if Hashem hadn't taken them out of Egypt, right, we would still be slaves in Egypt today. Implying that, that's already sending the message. We have to look at this as if we ourselves are leaving Egypt. We have to look at it and say, we have to personalize it. Why do we have to specify this personalization again at the end of the Seder? So he quotes the Gemara in Sota that a maidservant who crossed the Yam Suf saw Hashem more clearly than Yechezkel Navi. As we start off by saying, we look at the Seder as Matchilin Beginus Messiah Meshavach. Beginning, we talk about slavery. The end, we talk about freedom. So in the beginning, we're saying, we have to realize what it would have been like for us to be slaves. Right? We have to personalize that message. Here it's saying, not, this doesn't mean we have to look at ourselves as slaves. In every generation, we have to look at ourselves as if we left Egypt. We have to have the amunah, the faith of the people that left Egypt. And as the Gemara says, a maidservant, a simple maidservant who crossed the Yam Suf, who crossed the Red Sea, saw Hashem more clearly than Yechezkel or any of the Nevi'im did. So that level of amunah they had, that faith in Hashem, that connection to Hashem they had, when they left Egypt, in every generation, we should strive for that as well. So we're saying there are really two different messages, one in the beginning, one in the end. Okay. The Afikomen. So Rav Naftali Stern's Dessal says, so why is our custom to steal the Afikomen, right? We're hiding it, we're stealing it. Every family does it a little differently. So it says, we need to remember every mitzvah of Yetzias Mitzrayim. The Pasuk says, but against the children of Israel, no dog shall wet its tongue, against neither man nor beast, so that you shall know that Hashem will have differentiated between Egypt and Israel. In the 10th plague, they're fully protected. Even dogs were not allowed to attack the Jewish people during the 10th plague. So that was part of the miracle, that even an animal that just works on instinct would not attack the Jews there. They were so protected during that 10th plague that nothing could happen to them. So we want to represent that miracle somehow, the miracle of not even an animal, not even a dog, would attack us. How do we represent that? So the Gemara says that the nature of dogs is to steal, right? If you, dogs are always, you know, trying to get food from your plate. They're always trying to find something. They're always trying to grab something. So stealing the Afikomen is a way of representing that the way a dog would act. It's representing that miracle that even dogs didn't attack us. That's how we understood it. All right, we'll end with this one. The fifth coast, the cup of Eliyahu HaNavi. So it's one thing to sing about Eliyahu HaNavi. It's a little weird to pour a cup for him, right? So it almost seems like, you know, we're pouring milk and cookies for Santa Claus. Like, what are we doing here? We're pouring a cup for Eliyahu HaNavi? And, you know, as kids, we had to sit there and measure it and see if any of the wine went down. It doesn't seem very Jewish. It seems like the type of thing we normally would do, to pour a cup for Eliyahu HaNavi. It just seems weird, right? I don't know if you've had the experience. Seems like not the type of thing we normally would do.
Santa Claus, is that his winter job?
Well, what did the...
Eliyahu?
This is his spring job, right? Yeah. He gets milk and cookies in the winter. The Christians get milk and cookies, we get wine, you know? He likes this better.
We used to take this very seriously.
What do you mean?
The whole Eliyahu HaNavi thing.
You used to, but I mean, you don't anymore?
Well, when I was a kid, you know.
Yeah. No, it's like it's a big part of the Seder.
Shake the table, you know. Right. Some of it came off the top. He was here.
Right. Well, what we would do is
to open the door.
Especially if we Well, what we would do is, especially if we had like guests over who'd never been there before, one of the kids would like sneak out the back door of the house and circle around to the front door. So when they'd open for Elio and Nubby, we'd be there and like, you know, like scare everyone,
yeah,
you know?
Thing.
Yeah, it's right. So it's like a, but it's right. So is it Halloween? Like what, it's a weird thing. It just doesn't seem like the type of thing Jews would normally do. Like, you know, we have the Ushpizin and Sukkis, so we talk about them. We don't like pretend, we don't like set a plate for Avraham, right? So the Tzaddik of Warsaw, they go in Rabbi Chaim Yaakov Naftali Zilberberg, who was a student of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, explains as follows. So he says, you know, we have the four cups of wine for the four languages of Ge'ula, the four languages of salvation. The fifth, but there's really five languages of salvation. The fifth one is Ve'heveti, and I will bring. I mean, I'll bring you to Israel. That part is not represented with a cup. That fifth language will bring you to Israel is represented with this fifth cup of Eliyahu. I will bring you to Israel. But it's not just a reference to them going to Israel after 40 years in the desert. It's representative of Hashem bringing us back to Israel. It represents the coming of the Mashiach, it's returning to Eretz Israel. And Eliyahu HaNavi is seen as an integral part of us returning to Eretz Israel. What role Eliyahu will play is the whole question. But even in the Gemara, whenever says, you know, a shaila we can't answer, you know, the answer is, well, we'll ask Eliyahu HaNavi when Mashiach comes, right? That's Eliyahu and Mashiach are interconnected. So the fifth cup is not just about Eliyahu, it's about, you know, the coming of Mashiach, us hoping for Mashiach. So we have a fifth cup for this fifth language of Gula, Ve'heveti, I'll bring you to Eretz Yisrael. But it's not enough to just talk about it, we wanted to have a physical cup to show that it's a real thing. Because, you know, you talk about Mashiach, it's very ephemeral, it's, you know, it's in the clouds. But we want to have a cup, not to give Eliyahu something to drink, to show that this is real, that's tangible, it's actually in reality. We really are hoping, we really believe that Mashiach will come, and Eliyahu is part of that process. That's how he understands it. That, to me, is a little better than, you know, that makes a little more sense from a, more consistent with what we would normally do and normally think. There's 20 highlights. Anything else? Any other questions or things you want to add? Let me know.